as that band of cloud and rain eventually pushes south, but much of Scotland and Northern Ireland will have a bright day with good deal of sunshine around, just a few showers too. A much cooler day in store with temperatures this afternoon reaching the mid-teens Celsius at best with a cool northwesterly breeze. Now for Friday, a much more autumnal feeling day for all, with fresh and cool northerly winds and outbreaks of persistent rain across England and Wales, some of which will be heavy and thundery with a risk of some surface flooding in places. Best of the brightness will be Scotland and Northern Ireland, but feeling much cooler and fresher for all, with temperatures in the mid to high teens Celsius at best. As we head into the weekend, low pressure stays in control, so cool and breezy with sunny spells and showers.
Thanks very much indeed, Stav. And now our book of the week. British forces enter a deserted White House and feast on the dinner left behind by a fleeing President Madison in today's episode of When Britain Burned the White House by Peter Snow.
A small detachment of British soldiers, led by Rear Admiral George Cockburn and Major General Robert Ross, accompanied by their staff officers, approached the supreme sanctum of American power. It was an hour before midnight on the 24th of August, 1814. The White House was dark, deserted, and unprotected. Arthur Brooke, one of Ross's brigade commanders, wrote later,
"I found it hard to believe the Americans would tamely allow a handful of British soldiers to advance into the heart of their country and burn and destroy the capital of the United States."
Ross and Cockburn entered the mansion of the fourth President of the United States as easily as if they'd been invited guests. It was by far the finest and most elegant building in Washington, the brainchild of America's first president, George Washington, who'd wanted to see a residence that would be the centerpiece of his new city. Washington's chosen architect, James Hoban, an Irishman from Kilkenny, designed him the fine Anglo-Palladian building with its ornate stonework decoration that is still, with the exception of the later porticos north and south, the essence of today's White House. It wasn't just the ornamentation that was built to last. It was the very fabric of the building itself. The sandstone from the Aquia quarries in Virginia formed the outer layer, 16 inches thick, and to seal the porous sandstone, the exterior was coated with several layers of whitewash. This was the magnificent mansion, 14 years old by this time, and lovingly furnished by the president's wife, Dolly Madison, that Cockburn, Ross, and their staff now explored by torchlight. And they were immediately struck by the smell of cooked food emanating from the dining room and the kitchen nearby. None of them had eaten properly since an early breakfast around 5 or 6 that morning. None of them imagined they would be treated to a feast prepared for a president. Cockburn's aide-de-camp, James Scott, wrote,
"We found the cloth laid for the expected victorious generals, and all the appliances and means to form a feast worthy of the resolute champions of Republican freedom."
The table was laid for 40, with a damask tablecloth, matching napkins, silver and delicate wine glasses. In the kitchen they discovered more.
"Spits loaded with joints of various sorts turned before the fire. Pots and saucepans stood upon the grate, and all the other requirements for an elegant and substantial repast were in the exact state which indicated they had been lately and precipitately abandoned."
Scott walked over to where he saw the wines cooling in ice and helped himself to at least one generous glassful.
"Fagged nearly to death, dusty, feverish and thirsty, in my extremity I absolutely blessed them for their erring providence. Never was nectar more grateful to the palates of the gods than the crystal goblet of Madeira and water I quaffed at Mr. Madison's expense."
Then the British party explored the White House to look for a few souvenirs. In the president's dressing room upstairs, they noticed a lot of drawers half opened with contents spilling onto the floor. They reckoned it was either the work of local pilferers earlier or the results of Dolly's rush to grab what she could before she escaped. Cockburn helped himself to one of James Madison's hats and snatched a cushion from Dolly Madison's chair, saying with a smirk that it would remind him of her seat. James Scott went off upstairs and tried on one of Madison's shirts. A 23-year-old lieutenant in the 85th Light Infantry, glorying in the name of Beecham Colclough Urquhart, had a lucky find. He spotted James Madison's very smart dress sword and reckoned it would make a fine addition to his collection. Ross and Coburn appear to have had no difference of opinion about what was to happen next. There was that outstanding score to settle. Revenge for the American burning of the capital of Upper Canada. Robert Ross readily gave his assent to the act that was to echo down the ages as one of the most humiliating moments in American history. Once his men had finished devouring the president's supper, Ross ordered the chairs to be piled on the tables and the furniture in all the rooms stacked up so that the fire would devour as much as possible. It was Coburn's men, the team of sailors, who went about the business of setting light to all the chairs, tables, curtains, and upholstery. General Ross's aide, Harry Smith, wrote,
"I shall never forget the destructive majesty of the flames as the torches were applied to beds, curtains, etc. Our sailors were artists at their work."
In seconds, the flames swept through the main reception rooms on the ground floor and devoured all the furniture and soft furnishings that Dolly Madison hadn't managed to rescue. Within minutes, the interior was a raging inferno. Only the great stone walls would withstand the destructive force of the conflagration. The British officers who'd been instrumental in preparing the White House for destruction had mixed feelings about their handiwork. Harry Smith reckoned his old boss, the Duke of Wellington, would never have behaved like this. Charles Furlong, one of the party from the 21st Fusiliers who had eaten at the President's table, had his doubts too.
"I must confess, I felt sorrow when witnessing such magnificent buildings demolished."
The fires at the White House and Congress raged on, and it was only when the heavens opened later that the rain brought merciful relief to the stone outer walls that still stood in both buildings. They survive to this day, though they have been massively enlarged, strengthened, and restored, and the White House still bears the scars, the burn marks, from the fire of that night. It was midnight, but Ross and Coburn had not finished yet. The Treasury building was only just across the road from the White House. The two commanders were by this time so impatient to get the job done that they ordered the firing of the Treasury before they'd properly examined it. The flames had already taken hold when someone discovered a great iron door into what looked like a strongroom. The men contrived to manhandle some heavy chests out onto the street, but it turned out their effort was in vain. The Americans had taken care to remove all the gold and silver in their retreat. General Ross went off to catch up on sleep, leaving Coburn to settle one more score. He and Scott had spotted the offices of the National Intelligencer, the newspaper that had often used colourful language to describe Coburn's depredations of the last few months. Coburn was just ordering the place to be burned down when a bevy of local women appeared to plead with him not to start a fire that would threaten their houses. He agreed and ordered the building pulled down with ropes passed through one window and out of another. This allowed the men to heave down the wooden-framed building. All the papers inside were piled into a large bonfire, and the printing press itself was smashed to pieces in the street. James Scott reports that the women asked him for the name of this chivalrous British officer who had granted their request to spare their houses. When told it was Coburn,
"A half-uttered shriek of terror escaped from the lips of some of them as the dreaded name tingled on their ears. The announcement was electrifying. They had absolutely stood in the presence of and amiably conversed with that most venomous of all British serpents, and for whose head a reward of $1,000 had been publicly offered."
They parted on the best of terms. A number of Americans commented on how Coburn's restraint and respect for the citizenry of Washington contrasted with his barbaric reputation. Margaret Bayard Smith, as patriotic as any Washingtonian, observed in a letter about Coburn and his men,
"They were perfectly polite to the citizens. He bade them complain of any soldier that committed the least disorder, and had several severely punished for very slight offenses. All provisions were paid for."
James Madison was the only US president in history to be a fugitive in his own country, other than George W. Bush, who nearly two centuries later retreated to the US Strategic Command bunker at Offutt Air Force Base in Bellevue, Nebraska, on the 11th of September 2001, when terrorists struck the Twin Towers and other targets. Madison's flight was far less efficiently organized. He crossed the Potomac at 6 p.m. on the 24th of August, accompanied by Richard Rush, the Attorney General, and the Navy Secretary William Jones. They had no idea where Dolly Madison or the rest of the Jones family were, and so the president sent off a note which he hoped would find her, suggesting they meet at Wiley's Tavern near the Great Falls of the Potomac. Madison and his companions rode on horseback about 6 miles up the west bank of the river, safely inside Virginia. Every now and then they'd pause on a piece of high ground and glance back at the fires in the capital. The next day, the 25th of August, 1814, Dolly Madison and her friends and attendants reached Wiley's Tavern, the appointed meeting place. She was in for a shock. The inn was full of fugitive women whose husbands were still with the army, and the moment they recognized Dolly, they vented their anger on her for all their misfortunes. According to the Madison servant, Paul Jennings, Dolly was unceremoniously shouted at after she'd gone upstairs for a moment.
The lady of the house, learning who she was, became furious and went to the stairs and screamed out, "Miss Madison, if that's you, come down and go out. Your husband has got mine out fighting, and damn you, you shan't stay in my house. So get out."
The president himself came in for some catcalls when he reached the tavern later on, exhausted and soaked to the skin by driving rain. In spite of this humiliation, both James and Dolly Madison managed to arrange to stay at the tavern. But at midnight, the rumor went around that the British were coming, and one story has it that Madison's aides hurried him out of bed and into hiding in a small hovel in the woods. Before he left, he told Dolly to disguise herself and leave the tavern at dawn. Little did the president and his wife know it, but far from advancing beyond Washington, the British had already left. The British commanders, Coburn and Ross, had spent their first night in Washington sleeping soundly as the city's public buildings blazed around them. They were with their troops near the Capitol building. All the next morning, the burning and destruction went on. The light infantry replaced the fusiliers as the core of the occupying force. Captain Wainwright of HMS Tonnant led a naval demolition party to the Navy Yard first thing in the morning and set about completing the work that Tingey, the Yard's own commandant, had started the night before. Then they went on to burn down the War Office. Later that afternoon, a storm of wind and rain struck the city and the area around it. It was so violent, many called it a hurricane. According to one eyewitness,
"The sky changed from the peculiar leaden hue pretending a windstorm into almost midnight blackness. Then came the crash and glare of incessant thunder and lightning, and the wild beating of the rain, mingled with the sound of roofs tearing from their supports, and the whirr of heavy bodies flying through the air and falling upon the ground beneath."
General Ross now decided that the time had come to abandon Washington and return to the ships. The mission had been successfully accomplished. Decisive defeat and utter humiliation of the enemy. The proudest monuments of America's capital devastated. The question now was what effect the victory would have on the war and whether there was anything more the British task force could do to hasten its end. If the army could swiftly destroy another major American city, Britain could be close to landing a knockout blow. Only 35 miles up the road from Washington lay a no less tempting target, the city of Baltimore.
When Britain Burned the White House was written by Peter Snow and read by Jamie Parker. It was a heavy entertainment production.